Hi, writers. I'm glad you are with me for our new episode on the craft and the art of writing fiction. This is Jim Thayer. I mentioned my phrase notebook in an earlier episode, but I was just asked about it by a listener, and so let me mention it again. It's been a remarkably helpful tool for me, and a phrase notebook might be useful for you too. In the phrase notebook, I jot down phrases I come up with, 2, 3, 4 words, and phrases from other novels that I run across when reading. Why are remembering and using strong phrases important? A strong phrase, a forceful, maybe a lovely phrase, can make a sentence a piece of art. It can lift up the prose and it can lift up the reader. And there's a thrill for us writers when inventing such a phrase. It's one of the most rewarding elements of writing. A phrase that clicks, that lights us up as we write it, is a thrill. The essayist Joseph Epstein talks about coming up with a powerful and lovely phrase or a sentence. This is Joseph Epstein. How many beautiful sentences does a prose writer need to compose before he or she is acknowledged a master? 100? 500? 1,000? I may have struck off a dozen or so in my time, and when I have done so, I have always known it for swish, goal, touchdown. There is no other feeling like it. That's Joseph Epstein. I agree. It's a wonderful feeling to invent a lovely and powerful phrase. Many years ago, I bought a 3-ring binder, put 25 blank pages into it, and then put a blank tab on each of those pages. You know, those little tabs, sometimes called file folder tabs or binder tabs. You can buy dozens of them for a few dollars at an office store. They have sticky ends that you attach to the page, and then you can write on them your classifications. They make finding the right page easy in the notebook. So I had a 3-ring binder divided with blank pages, and each with a tab. If I sat there composing, and if I invented a phrase I thought suitable or even good, I used it in the fiction I was writing and also wrote it down in the phrasebook. I'd also write down in the phrasebook excellent phrases I came across while reading. Writing down phrases you read in a novel? Jim, you exclaim, isn't copying down a phrase I read in a novel, then maybe using it later, plagiarism? No. Were I a chuckler, I'd chuckle at the question. In 2010, Google determined how many unique books there were in the world since the invention of Gutenberg's press, printing press, in the year 1440. Using data from libraries, ISBNs, and more, they determined that the number is 129,864,880. Those books laid end to end would entirely circle the earth. And this Google data excludes books published after 2010. According to UNESCO, 2.2 million books are published each year now. Can a phrase be unique? Can it be copyrighted? Do authors have some sort of moral or legal claim to a phrase? I just went to Google Books, which instantly searches the texts of millions of books, and you can type the exact phrase you're looking for, and I typed in the phrase, a glassy smile. It's a terrific phrase, one that's in my phrase book. She had a glassy smile. Google Books reveals that Alfred Lord Tennyson used it in his poem, Maud, a Monodrama. Here is Tennyson. Her brother, from whom I keep aloof, who wants the finer politic sense to mask, though but in his own behoof, with a glassy smile, his brutal scorn. This phrase, a glassy smile, has been used in fiction and nonfiction dozens and dozens of times, maybe hundreds of times. I didn't care to count them all at Google Books. And it's true with almost all phrases. So if I come across a powerful and lovely phrase in my reading, I might copy it down in my used phrases book. And if I invent one, I write it down. And I don't wonder if it's original. No phrase is original. But maybe most of the phrases in my phrases book I invented, getting a particular charge out of coming up with a phrase I liked. I'd write it down. Why do I keep a phrases book in case I find a place to use it again in some future writing project? If I have to describe a smile, I might open the phrase book. Much of the time, though, when I open the phrase notebook, I'm not looking for a phrase used before, but I'm looking for inspiration. I'm looking for a prompt. So when I read in my phrase notebook, a glassy smile, I come up right then with the phrase, a shiny smile. Say, that's a good phrase. I just invented it. Has it been used before in other novels? Who knows? I don't care. And I'm not even going to go to Google Books to look. If we go to Google Books to search millions of books for phrases that have been used before so that we won't use them in our own writing, we'll never write a thing, not one word. Every phrase has been used before, usually hundreds or thousands of times. Some phrases in fiction have become so popular that we should avoid using them. Of course, his face was as cold as a carving is from Raymond Chandler in one of his hard-boiled Los Angeles detective novels. His face was as cold as a carving, and it's so wonderful, it's immortal. We shouldn't use it. And there are some other phrases. An offer he couldn't refuse from Mario Puzo. We don't use these, of course. You'll know them when you think of them. My phrase book is a three-ring binder. It's also in a Word document on my laptop, but there's a particular satisfaction in the old school opening a three-ring binder and seeing the phrases on paper, some of which are in my own handwriting. Every couple of years, I update the Word document on my computer and print out the pages again. I'm selective. Even though I've been collecting phrases for decades, there are only, for example, 11 entries describing a nose. So consider coming up with a phrases book, a phrases notebook of your own. It'll often get you over a creative hump. And let me lend a hand by listing the tabs in my phrases notebook, and you might consider using these tabs. There are 22 of them, and they are alphabetical in the phrase book, and the first tab is body. And under that tab on that page, and it's a standalone page with no other phrases on it but those related to body, are phrases such as an agreeable stoop. Isn't that a nice phrase? Another one is disagreeably flabby. Another one is his thin shoulders hunched protectively. Those are in my use phrases notebook under body. The next tab is colloquialisms, snappy phrases I've come up with or found, such as loud as a pig in a gate. That's wonderful. I probably didn't come up with that myself. Killed him graveyard dead. They scattered like poultry. Those are phrases in my colloquialism tab on that page. Next one is colors. Examples are bone white, gas blue, white as flax, salt white, howling red. The next tab is emotions. And under that is a glum silence, roiling thoughts. The next one is expressions, such as the lightly pained expression of one enduring tight shoes. Isn't that a great phrase? Also under that tab, a black scowl. He gave me a corrosive look. His face slowly congealed. Those are on the page with the tab expressions. The next one is eyes. Examples are blank, puzzled eyes sunk deeply and bagged, faded blue eyes. The next tab on the next page is face, such as an over-featured face, an expressionless face. The next tab is hair, and under that, on that page, is a badger's streak of gray, bald as a peeled egg, hair bristly like a badger's, silk fine hair. The next tab is hands, and under that are the phrases blunt hands, folding her hands together. Knuckles of his hand gleamed like ivory. And the next tab is look. She regarded me narrowly. She looked intently into my face, as if it were a clouded window. He stared pensively. The next tab is mannerisms/gestures. And under that tab are, for example, a weak, wet handshake. He bit down in rage. He drew himself up stiffly. He rubbed his scalp as if to warm a memory. The next tab is mouth/smile. A glassy smile. A smile of mild cynicism. A vulping grin, isn't that nice? A wintry smile, an empty smile. The next tab is nautical, where I wrote down phrases regarding the sea. Violent pitching and wallowing. The heave and roll of the deck. The next tab is nose. A flippant nose. A gangster's flat nose. I like that phrase so much I know I've used it more than once. I can't recall if I invented it or someone else did. A masterful nose. His nose was a rosy knob. And then there's the tab labeled other. This is where I jot down a phrase that doesn't fit under the other tabs, such as the world had worn him away. One remembers last chances. A knife came out, gleaming like hope. The next tab is physical world. The silvered grass in the moonlight. A high, misty, indifferent moon. The next tab is presence. A lot of passion there kept under tight control. A poisonous nephew. Isn't that fantastic? A small, nippy man. An assertive brawler's presence. The next tab is sea. Here, too, I've got tabs involving the ocean. Deep breaking tops. A smother of spray. And I guess I didn't know the word spume because I wrote it down under the sea tab. The next tab is skin, as pale as candle glass. As pale as candle wax. A cloistered pallor. A sallow tinge. The next tab is voice. A bright, insolent laugh. A dry, compulsive cough. A laugh that would start a truck. As far as I can recall, I invented that phrase, and I'm proud of it. A pavement voice, a silky voice. The next tab, walked/moved. And under that tab, heavy rolling steps. Trembled. He slunk off. And the last tab is weather/light. Opalescent clouds. Isn't that a lovely phrase? Thin, watery sunshine. The tiny ghosts of dawn. Maybe you'll find this listing of the tabs in my phrasebook useful. If you don't have a phrasebook, consider creating one. I suspect you'll find it enormously useful over your writing career. I'd like to talk about how we can know if our plot is working. I received this message from our listener, Aaron. This is Aaron. Sometimes when I'm thinking about my story and what I should do with it next, I feel stuck, and no direction feels right for this story or characters. I feel like the plot just doesn't work sometimes. How do you know if a plot or a story is working or not? That's Aaron. What a great question. I had to think about it. It impresses me as an important topic, which is, how can a writer know if a story is working? For a lot of us, we get too close to the story we're writing. We've worked hard on it for a long while, and the story becomes hard to judge. When I was a kid, I loved Little Lulu comic books. One story in the comic book has stuck with me over the decades. Lulu tells her friend Tubby that if you think about a word hard enough, it loses its meaning. She offers the word foot and says something like, "Think about it hard, foot, 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 foot." And soon the word foot no longer means anything. That Little Lulu story stuck with me as the truth, and I have remembered it. It might be true with our fiction. We work and think and work and think about a story, and soon it loses some meaning, and we can't judge it. Let me mention a couple of questions we might ask ourselves to determine if our story is working. I don't know of a big magic way to see if our story's strong, but maybe we can break down the problem by asking some questions. The first question is enough at stake? Big stakes lead to big drama. Many successful novels are the story of the most important thing ever to happen to the protagonist. Something big should be the central issue of the story. If the central issue in our story is whether our protagonist gets a promotion, or there's likely not enough at stake, or whether she gets into a top school, or whether her child gets into a good school, or whether we can take off 10 pounds, or whether she gets good tickets for the football games. Some things in life, as important as they may seem to us in real life at the moment, aren't worthy of fiction. If the plot isn't working, we should ask ourselves, is there enough oomph in the plot? Is there enough at stake? A good thing about something being big, something big being at the heart of the story, is that it's a big goal for the writer. It's easier to keep the story headed the right direction without distractions if there's something big at stake in the story. A second question we might ask ourselves is the story question clear? This is related to enough being at stake. Does the reader know what the protagonist wants and how badly she wants it? Making the story question clear gives the writer a clear goal, and the writer will be less likely to wander off into novel elements that don't fit the story or don't propel the story forward. A third question we can ask is the timeline clear? Without too much going back in time for backstory and flashbacks, plots are easier to follow if they flow forward so the reader knows when things are happening. A fourth question we might ask ourselves is our character sufficiently punchy? We writers, including me, guilty, Your Honor, often tend to make our main characters too much like us. Unless we are a member of the Delta Force, it's a mistake. You and I, and pardon me if I'm wrong about you, typically aren't the stuff of fiction. Big, dynamic, interesting, punchy characters cause things to happen in fiction. I'm not necessarily talking about commandos. Big personalities can exist in romance and literary fiction, characters that act, characters who move forward. Maybe one of the reasons our story feels as if it has no direction is that we don't have a punchy protagonist driving this story. We might ask ourselves, is our character big and bold enough? A fifth question Are there too many characters? Too many characters can dilute a story. Every character of any note has to be accounted for, and some aspects of the story must be devoted to that character. Otherwise, why are they in the story? And usually, his or her fate in the story should be made clear. It takes time and typing to account for characteristics for many characters, and it might lead a writer to wander off the main story question. If a character isn't needed in a story, leave him out. Does that character directly contribute to the story's forward momentum? If not, delete the character. A sixth question. Are there too many story threads? If a plot angle were deleted, would the story still make sense? If so, that angle might not be needed. It might be diluting the story for the writer, making it seem aimless. All the threads of a novel, meaning the different plot angles, need to come together as the story ends. We can ask ourselves, am I feeling I have no direction in my story because I'm trying to or have to pull too many plot threads together to finish the story? A seventh question, is the novel's time span, the days over which the story takes place, the least amount we can make it? A shorter time period often means a tighter plot. It means the writer usually thinks in a more cause and effect way. The screenwriters of the movie 3 Days of the Condor knew this. The book on which the movie was based was titled 6 Days of the Condor. They tightened it up. An eighth question, are you following a cause and effect formula? Cause and effect, of course, refers to the relationship between two events, where one event, the cause, makes another event happen, the effect. It explains why something happens. Not all our causes in the story need to be or should be explained right away. Some of the causes are hidden from the reader and maybe from the protagonist, but much of what we are writing should be if A, then B. And if that's the case, the story won't seem to bog down. A ninth question we can ask, is the climax of the story at the very end? The main story question shouldn't be answered 3/4 of the way or 7/8 of the way into the story, but rather at the end. If we are looking at the ending pages of the novel and the story seems to go soft, it may be that we've answered the story question too early and that there isn't enough tension in the last part of the novel. A story's walkaway, where the handsome cowboy rides off into the sunset, should be short, a couple of pages. So those are some things we might ask ourselves if our story seems to be bogging down, if we are wondering whether our story is lost. If we can answer them with a right yes or no answer, we just talked about, our story is likely strong and is moving forward. I received a nice email from Tim in Lubbock, Texas. And he mentioned two related things that I've asked listeners about, the power of fiction and the story that first grabbed us when we were young. Tim writes, when I was in 8th grade, our class was tasked with creating a story, which I must have done quite well at. Unfortunately, I don't remember what the story was about, but it changed my mother's life forever. Probably not in the way you're thinking now, but the story I told was supposedly good enough that I got an A+ grade, only to my mom's discontent. My daughter tells me that her grandma, my mom, went into being an English teacher after seeing my A+ grade on a paper with the most horrendous grammar she'd ever seen. My mom remains an English and literary teacher, directs and produces one-act plays, all because my good story had such horrible grammar and the teacher refused to reduce my grade over it. I'd hang my head low, but all things happen in reason, and she now loves what she does. Tim's bad grammar made his mother become an English teacher. What a great thing. It's just charming. Then Tim talks about a book he loved when he was a child. This is Tim. To me, the most impactful novel I ever read was while I was still playing with Ninja Turtles and crawling the stairs to get to my top bunk, even though the bottom bunk remained empty. It was Where the Red Ferns Grow by Wilson Rawls. I'll never forget the emotion it brought to me when I entered that world and lived with young Billy and those coon dogs laying in my top bunk and hiding under the covers with my flashlight, just to make sure the dogs survived, saving little Billy from the frozen river. That's Tim. Where the Red Fern Grows seized Tim. Maybe we are writing such a story. We are working right now on a novel or short story that is going to change people's lives, that'll grab them and change them. What a nice thought. I'd like to think there are listeners to this podcast right now who are writing such a story, and I'll bet I'm right. If you'd like to send me a message, my email address is jimthayerseattle@gmail.com, and I'd like to hear from you. Until then, this is Jim Thayer. Please keep tapping those keys.